If you remember last week, we started looking at the significance of the seals. I mean, we've already kind of explored verses 1 through 8, the first four seals, which are the four horses and their four horsemen. And I thought this would be a kind of a good place to kind of see what the significance of not just the first four, but even the latter three seals, so all seven together. We're trying to see how they would apply not only to the book of Revelation as a whole, but we also considered the prophecy of Jesus. And we spent a lot of time last week looking at the parallels between the seals of Revelation and the prophecy of Jesus in his Olivet Discourse that we find in the Gospels. It's especially found in Matthew chapter 24, but there's also an account in Luke and in Mark. But probably Matthew 24 is the most well-known. It's probably perhaps the more in-depth prophecy that the Lord Jesus gives. And if you remember, it was kind of the time period between his return to heaven and his return from heaven. And it covers a lot of time period in between. The period that we can describe as sort of general tribulation is what we're going through even today. The beginning of sorrows that will lead to a great tribulation that is still yet in our future. And basically the Lord just, Jesus telling his believers to just keep watching, right? Keep watching for his return and his coming. So just a quick review of where we've been. What we looked at last week. When it comes to the function of the seals, and that's, so really the first two points are from the first two points last Sunday, and then we'll get into the third point, which begins our new lesson. But when it comes to the function of the seals, I think we can see the first four seals as working together to perform God's general work of judgment on this world before the return of Christ to this world. And I think that's probably something that you can see in Matthew 24 and the parallels here in Revelation chapter 6. Sort of the background for the horses and the horsemen coming together to function together to really accomplish one main purpose of judgment, though they have different missions for themselves. The main Old Testament background is Zechariah 6, which we looked at several times already. But again, John is not seeing what Zechariah is seeing. It's not the same vision, but it's the background to his vision. And so some of the things that you can find in Zechariah can be applied to John's. And I think probably two main things that can be applied are the common presence of the horses. That is, they're all together working and doing what God wants them to do at the same time, and their common purpose. The common purpose for the horses in Zechariah and the horses and horsemen in Revelation were for judgment. And of course, that's something that we see also here in the book of Revelation. So I think that's one of the reasons why we can see them functioning together and even having a common presence and purpose as well. And so we spent a little time looking at verse 8 of this chapter, where we find the instruments of death that are used by death and hell. Again, death is a very unique personage here. He's the only one that's named. He's the only one that has a partner. He's the only one that's described not necessarily as sitting on top of the horse, but maybe even hovering on over the horse. The instruments of death that are used by death can also be seen as a summary of all four of the missions of the four riders and their horsemen. I like how James Hamilton puts it. He says, there is a sense in which the fourth horse summarizes the first four and ties them together. And so we kind of looked at how even the first seal with the very last instrument of judgment, where you have the first one coming on a mission of conquest, and perhaps those beasts of the earth are not just animals, but men who act like animals, who would, again, conquest. We see an inclusio, sort of just the Latin word that kind of brings all those together so they function together on one common mission. He also describes it this way. He says, the repeated occurrence of the fourfold formulas of judgment outside of Ezekiel 14:21 enforces the idea that Revelation 6:8 is a broad summary of the previous three horsemen. So there are quite a few that actually see this verse 8 as sort of a summary of really all of them, tying them all together so that we can see them working together. Now, when it comes to the fulfillment of the seals, we spent, I think, most of our time looking at this last time. When it comes to fulfillment of the seals, we can also see that all seven seals fulfill the prophecy of Jesus in his Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24. And again, we describe this as especially the time between the fall of Jerusalem in the past. Remember, that's something that he was describing to his disciples. You know, Jesus said, don't be impressed with everything around here, because all of these buildings will be thrown down, right? And that literally took place in AD 70 when Rome came in and conquered Jerusalem and totally changed the landscape of Jerusalem itself. I mean, the city was completely changed into a Roman city. It was so decimated, not just the Temple Mount, but the entire city was burned and plundered and just broken up, that it was completely different than when Jesus actually was there. And so the time between the fall of Jerusalem in the past and then the return of Jesus still in the future, that is where we find not only most of Jesus's discourse in Matthew 24, but also we can see the parallels between what Jesus taught and the seven seals, which Jesus uses to remind John of the beginning of sorrows that would precede his coming. I think when we consider Matthew 24, as we did, and if you miss some of that or you'd like to go back to that, all of these are available online. You can go through that entire series on Matthew 24. But basically, this is the time period known as the beginning of sorrows or the beginning of birth pangs. And obviously, it's been that way since the return of Christ to heaven, fall of Jerusalem, and will be that way until Jesus comes. This is the period of general tribulation that we're in that will lead up to the final great tribulation. So just like a woman's birth pains, just like a woman's labor, it doesn't happen all at once. It continues to grow and intensify in frequency and in intensity. And so that's what the great tribulation is. If this time period in which we live is known as the beginning of birth pangs, the beginning of sorrows, that's going to be the final birth pangs, the final chapter, the final sorrows, which will lead to his coming. And so there's a lot of parallels that we looked at between the Olivet Discourse and the seven seals. And again, Jesus is just reminding John of something he already knew, something he'd already learned. But this would yet be before Jesus tells John more about what will happen in that final culminating great tribulation that will come upon both the world and his people. Now, as far as one of those things that Jesus said would happen during this time period in which we live even, in Matthew 24:5, he says, "For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ." And of course, that would correspond with, if we look at the first seal and the negative standpoint, the anti-Christian spirit. And, you know, Ron was talking about historically, even, is there some way that we can kind of look back and see, you know, what some of those might have been? And actually, I was able to do a little bit of research to kind of look and see, you know, if there have been many that would say that they're Christ or many that were said to be Christ. Again, obviously, Jesus is saying there are going to be many that say that they're Christ and will deceive many. But we also know that there's a lot of people that would say someone is Christ. And I printed this off for you, Ron, as well. But I have here, and this was just a collation of just a few different sources, but this is a whole list of people since the time of Christ who have said that they are the Christ. Even before AD 70, I mentioned this, I think, last Sunday, that Josephus, who was a Jewish historian around the time of Christ, he actually witnessed AD 70. He witnessed the destruction of Jerusalem. And the reason why he was able to was he was kind of considered to be sort of a traitor and kind of on the side of Rome. And he was actually watching what was taking place and recording some of this. But he said one of the reasons because of this, or one of the reasons for AD 70 was because of all the people that said they were Christ. Of course, he would include Jesus of Nazareth. But a little after Jesus left this earth, he says there was a man named Thutis, two men named James and Simon, Dositheos the Samaritan was in the mid-first century, so around the 50s, said that the Samaritans thought he was the Jewish Messiah. There was somebody known as the Egyptian in the 50s, and so this is again before AD 70, Eleazar the son of Dineas, Menachem, son of Judas, these are all individuals that said that they were the Christ. And this is one of the reasons why Rome came down so hard on them, because the Christ that they were looking for was what kind of Christ? A conquering hero, right? A military leader. And Jesus showed what kind of Christ he really was as far as the first coming. The second coming, he'll come that way. But he had to first take care of some sin business before he would come and reign. But that's one of the reasons why Rome came down so hard on Israel and on Jerusalem. And then after AD 70, even after the destruction of Jerusalem, there was still a whole bunch. One of the main ones who died around 135, his name was Simon Bar Kokhba, or Simon the son of Kokhba. There was a little bit of information about him. It says he led a revolt against the Roman Empire in 132 to 135. He was hailed as Messiah King by a rabbi who actually referred to him using the book of Numbers. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite through the corners of Moab. So he was actually looking at Old Testament prophecy to describe this man that he was holding forth as the Messiah. He led a rebellion, found a short time or a short-lived Jewish state. He was killed in the siege of Betar, and of course, he stayed dead. That's the difference between these false messiahs, antichrists, and the Lord Jesus, who is the true Christ. He was killed, which was the final battle of the third Jewish-Roman war that devastated Judea. It took a while before any Jew would say that they were a Christ because of all that that happened, until a few hundred years, a guy named Moses of Crete claimed to be Messiah. Now, that's all during the first few hundred years after Christ. But now if you think about what's going on even today, there was one writer that was kind of listing a whole bunch even in the last 20, or since the 20th century. There was a guy named Yahweh Ben Yahweh. Interesting name. He was born as Hulan Mitchell, a black nationalist and separatist who created the Nation of Yahweh and allegedly orchestrated the murder of dozens of people. And so he claimed to be Christ. Now, you know, we would look at that and think, well, he's just a man, a terrorist, you know, a cult leader and all of these things. But I think a lot of those cults that we hear about are people that are claiming to be Christ. So I think you'll find this interesting. And I have the sources there as well. So we can see that, yes, what Jesus said was fulfilled, not just in the future. I think that there will still be many antichrists to come. There still are many antichrists to come. And some of those are, again, they pretend to be Christ either through intimidation or even through imitation. And I think the intimidation part we often see through, people like Adolf Hitler, who tried to transform the Lutheran Church into one of his own making. And of course, that too is an anti-Christian effort that we can see. He may not have said that he was Christ, but he was certainly putting himself in the place of Christ. So I think as you go through history, church history, you can see a lot of the Olivet Discourse coming to fulfillment, as well as the seals that we've looked at already, especially in those first four. So I would see the seven seals of Revelation describing the same things that Jesus described in his Olivet Discourse. I mentioned that last Sunday. Some of those things are going on right now, but I do think that some of those things are still yet in our future. We have the general tribulation, beginning of sorrows, Jesus talked about in his Olivet Discourse. It's taking place today through the first four seals. But there's a greater tribulation to come, which will culminate in the final outpouring of God's wrath as seen in the sixth seal. And then in the return of Christ as seen in the seventh seal. So I mentioned at the very beginning of our Book of Revelation study that there's different lines that people might place between our past and our future when it comes to the Book of Revelation. And that's where I would draw the line, is between seal number 5 and seal number 6. I think seal 1 through 5 is in our past and present, and yet 6 and 7 are yet to come. Again, it doesn't take anything away from the trumpet judgments that I still think are in the future. It doesn't take away anything from the bowl judgments, which are still in the future, dealing with a greater tribulation than even the tribulation that we have now. But I think if you see it this way, especially through that telescopic view, when you read Revelation, I think it'll make more sense. And there's going to be a couple of more reasons why here that we can look at even this morning. I like the summary that I read from James Hamilton as well. You can read it there on your lesson guide. He says the sequence of events that John, I think I misspelled that, that John describes once Jesus takes the scroll and begins to open its seals closely parallels the sequence of events Jesus prophesied in Matthew 24. So he would say Revelation 6 and Matthew 24 are complementary presentations of world history between the first and second comings of Christ. And I would even say from the fall of Jerusalem to the coming of Christ. But certainly that there wasn't a whole lot of time period, one generation between. All right, there are a couple more reasons why this might be the best way to look at the seven seals. And this is sort of new material. That was review, but this is new. And this is what we can call the features of the seals. The features of the seals themselves. Now, if you remember, all of Revelation 6 through 16, so we're not just talking about chapter 6 through 8, where we find the seven seals. All of Revelation 6 through 16 is given to us in terms of unsealing and unrolling a scroll. Now, even though John does learn something about the future when Jesus removes the seals, the seals still needed to be removed, and this is on your message guide. I don't have it up here. The seals needed to be removed before the contents of the scroll are fully revealed. So there is a difference between the sealed scroll and the open scroll. The sealed scroll remains sealed until all seven seals are open. That makes sense, doesn't it? And then the scroll can be revealed and the contents. George Eldon Ladd writes it this way, and we've seen this quote before. The breaking of the seven seals do not constitute the contents of the scroll. That's significant. But they're preliminary and preparatory to the actual opening of the scroll. So it shows to us that there is a difference between the seals and the trumpets and the bowls in that the seals have to be broken and opened before the contents of the rest of the scroll is revealed. So again, what is Jesus doing to John? He's reminding John of something he already learned from Jesus in Matthew 24. And then after the seventh seal is broken, and Jesus takes him right to the cusp of the coming of Christ, now he says, okay, John, here's more information I'm going to reveal to you in the trumpets and the bowls that is yet to come. And so this is something that would have encouraged him, because remember, the theme of Revelation is, behold, he comes with the clouds, and he keeps coming back to that. That's the seventh seal. That's the seventh trumpet. That's the seventh bowl. It's always pointing forward to the coming of Christ. And so that's why we look at it in that telescopic way, to keep that theme in view. So what we can call the main events of Revelation are still yet in our future. And they make up the content of the scroll itself. And that would include the trumpet and bowl judgments. But these main events that we're going to get into, they're still sealed up until Jesus reminds John of what he already told him in the Olivet Discourse. So keep that in mind. There is a difference between the seals and the rest of the scroll. The seals are what keeps the scroll closed. And once the seventh one is opened, then more detail is given to John about even what is in our future. Now, another feature of the seals, and this is perhaps the one that I struggled with the most when I was thinking through all of the different parameters of these views. Another feature of the seals that actually seems to go against this view of the seven seals, or really the first five seals taking place now, has been in verse 8, the mission of the fourth horse and rider. If you remember, we're told that to death and hell was given power over what? Over the fourth part of the earth. Now, we mentioned before that whenever there's a fraction in Revelation, it's very precise, it's very specific. But a lot of places, when you think about, when you come to this and you want to hear what people have to say about, you know, these four horsemen, a lot of people say, well, it's describing a fourth part of the population or the people of the earth. And certainly that, you know, from our perspective, it kind of makes sense. But that's not what it says. It says a fourth part of the earth. If you wanted to say here, a fourth part of the inhabitants of the earth, you could have said that. Because even when it talks about the trumpets, one of the trumpets deals with a third part of the inhabitants of the earth being killed. Very specific, very, very precise. So in this case, I would say it does not refer to a quarter of the population of the earth, but rather to a quarter of the earth in its geographic global sense. Throughout the book of Revelation, anytime you find the word earth, it's never used to deal specifically with the people of the earth. It's dealing with the global sense, the geographic sense of the earth. You can trace that throughout the entire book of Revelation. Every time just the word earth is used, it might be qualified. There might be inhabitants of the earth, right? And then it's obviously talking about the people of the earth. But anytime you find that word earth throughout Revelation, it's dealing with the geography of this world. So what we could say is that at any point in time over the course of history, since the time that Jesus showed the seals to John, even up until our time, or perhaps you could say ever since the time of the fall of Rome, even up until today, a quarter of the world in its global sense would experience the instruments of death that would bring about all kinds of death and carnage. And of course, we know what those instruments are from verse 8. Sword, hunger, pestilence, and human beasts. Now, can't that describe history? I mean, especially even today, even current events. I like how, I didn't put this on your lesson guide, I kind of saved it in case I needed it. But here we have one fella named Henry Barclay Sweet. He wrote a commentary in Revelation back in the early 1900s. So this is a fairly old commentary. And he puts it this way. He goes, "This series of pictures," referring to the seals, "this series of pictures repeats itself in history. And the militarism, the lust of conquest, which it represents, are among the forces set loose by the hand of Christ to prepare the way for his coming and the final publication of the secrets of the sealed book," the final publication of the contents of the scroll. And so this is something that we see throughout history, throughout even church history. Now, it does not mean that all four instruments of death will appear together at one place or at one place at a time. It could be all over the world, right? They often do appear together. I mean, when there's war, there's often famine. And when there's famine, there's, a lot of other deaths, disease and various things like that. It also does not mean that everyone who experiences these calamities will die. I mean, there's a lot of people that are affected and inflicted by war that do not die from that war. There's still a lot that do, but there are a lot that don't. And so, again, we got to try to keep in mind that it's not a quarter of the population. It's rather the quarter of the geographic sense of the world that is affected by these instruments. Not all at the same time, and certainly not everyone is going to die from these things who experience these calamities. But one of the things that we've seen in Revelation is unnatural death is a normal thing. It becomes a natural thing in this world. It could also be that the fourth is more of the intensification of the other three. So maybe we haven't even seen the fourth seal yet. Maybe that is reserved for the time of great tribulation. That certainly could be. But we do have the first three going on right now. We certainly see the conquest, the anti-Christian spirit that is rampant. We also see great conflict, and we certainly see a lot of great issues with commerce and famine and hunger and all of those things. So different ways that you can look at it. But I do think that when it comes to these four seals, especially, we definitely see its effects even today, not just yet to come, but even today. So that's what we can describe there. Now, one more thing is the fullness of the seals, and we'll talk about this fairly briefly and then open up for some questions. The fullness of the seals. If the seals were to begin in the near future of John, okay, so again, we're taking this back to when John gets this vision in Revelation. If these seals were to begin in the near future of John or even contemporary with John, it would also make sense of how Jesus told him to write the book of Revelation. Go back with me to the very first verse in Revelation chapter 1, verse 1. And John introduces the whole book. We spent some time even looking at this verse. When John says, "This is the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him to show unto his servants things which must what? Shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John. Now, this is a phrase and even a word that has been written about a lot in the literature concerning the book of Revelation. And it's certainly one of the things that when I was younger and I'd come to the book of Revelation, I would struggle with. You know, a lot of people have struggled with this. Okay, so if he's talking about things that shortly must come to pass, the most natural meaning is that the events described in Revelation will start to happen soon. Even in the lifetime of the author, the primary audience of Revelation, but will unfold over time until the return of Christ. That's the most natural understanding of this word shortly. There are some who say, well, okay, it just means that when Jesus is going to return, it's going to be without delay. So when all these things are going to start happening, it will happen all at once. I mean, that certainly is a way to look at it. But I struggle with it. And so a lot of people are struggling with it. They say, okay, well then, the things that must shortly come to pass deal with chapters 2 and 3. That would deal with the church age. But the church age is not something that was shortly to come to pass. The church age was something that was going on then for John, right? So the church age, Revelation 2 and 3, he was dealing with contemporary churches and contemporary issues within those churches. And those were not things that were shortly to come to pass. They were things that were happening then and there. So keep that in mind. Shortly come to pass. But then if you go down to verse 19, this is where we often get the basic outline of Revelation, right? John is also instructed in verse 19, write the things which thou hast seen, and the things which are, and the things which shall be hereafter. Now what do we have in that verse? We have the things that thou hast seen, that's past. The things which are, that's present. And the things which shall be hereafter, that's future. All right, so past, present, future. So it's almost, I would say, universally understood that the things which thou hast seen refer to the initial vision of Jesus in chapter 1. Because Jesus appears to John in this vision, and after he appears to John in this vision, he says, write the things which thou hast seen. And so he does. He says, this is what I saw. I heard a voice as of a trumpet speaking to me, and I turned around and look, and behold, and here's Jesus in all his glory, in all his manifestation. All right? It's also, I would say, almost universally understood that the things which are present refer to the seven churches of Asia, which are described in chapters 2 and 3. And so that would be the present. And certainly that's how we approached the seven churches of Revelation. We're not seeing, you know, each church as representative of a church, a distinct church age, because in any period of the church, you're going to find the same kinds of churches. You're going to see churches that are dealing with persecution and churches that are dealing with purity, right? You can say that not just in the world, but you can say that in our own community. There are churches that are dealing with persecution and churches that are dealing with purity. And so this is the way the church age is. You can see the whole gamut of those things. So that's contemporary. That's the things that are. But when John is told also to write about the things which shall be hereafter, there's a lot of people that will jump way past what John or what was in John's immediate future to even to our own future. And so they skip over. You know, they say, okay, well, you know, John is going to talk about chapters 4 and the rest of it, but it's going to be way still in our future. Everything's going to be in our future. So if some of the seals were taking place or about to take place in the near future of John, which is the idea of having the six seals or the seven seals represent Jesus' teaching in Matthew 24. If some of those seals are taking place in the near future for John, that would not only satisfy verse 19, but also verse 1. Wouldn't it? So yes, John is writing about the things which shall be hereafter, but we need to remember that what was future for John, some of that is past for us. So the things that will take place in the future, and here's a way of looking at it. The things which shall be in chapter 4, going from chapter 4 on, must shortly come to pass, verse 1. And so we would say that the first five seals deal with John's near future, So yes, they're happening. It fulfills Revelation 1 verse 1, and then it will continue on until ultimately the return of Christ. So that's another reason why I think that this view kind of helps us see Revelation a little bit better. Not seeing everything that John sees in the future, but if some of those things are still ongoing today, it fulfills verse 1. These are some things that must shortly come to pass, and they did, and they are. So again, under this approach, the seals review the events that Jesus taught in his Olivet Discourse. The effects of the first five seals will continue until the final judgment and return of Christ, which are revealed in the last two seals. And that's where I believe we currently are in the timeline of prophecy. If we had a timeline, I would say that the four horsemen are still out there to do whatever they can to inflict war and want and woe, again, those instruments upon mankind, even causing the death of many believers, which is seal number five, right? We're going to come to a bunch of people that are martyred, which is, again, this is the period of martyrdom. These sorrows will keep growing in intensity and frequency until the final judgments of God will be unleashed and Jesus himself returns to make everything wrong right. So that's the sixth and seventh. But what happens when all these seals are opened? The scroll is opened, right? The scroll is unrolled. More detail is given to John and to us about what will happen at the climax and the culmination of what we would say are the first five seals. So that's kind of where I stand as far as my understanding of these six seals. Again, others have seen it differently, and again, that's okay. But that's some of the reasons why I think I think it is the way it is, and it makes more sense when looking at the book of Revelation to see it in this telescopic approach, as well as looking at it as the seals, first five seals, dealing with contemporary issues that have been going on since the time of John, his near future. And then we still have more information to come about our far future. And that is what we find in the trumpets and the